Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today we're going to be talking to the director and associate director of Project Censored, the group which has been chronicling the most overlooked and uncovered news stories in the United States for several decades, looking at the new list for this year. But first, before we go to that show, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The FCC's received more critical comment on its proceeding to examine and revise its rules on media ownership. This time it's from its own Consumer Advisory Committee, which has issued a report calling for the FCC to freeze its ownership inquiry until its inspector general finishes an investigation into how at least two formal agency studies that criticized media consolidation were spiked and ordered destroyed. The committee would also like to know how the FCC spent $300,000 on a contract with Edison Media Research to analyze local radio content and what the results of that project were.
Debate over the issue of network neutrality is really starting to heat up outside the United States. Earlier this year, the dominant phone companies in Germany and Italy went on record as opposing the principle of internet freedom, asking national and European Union regulators for the ability to practice content discrimination over their fiber optic broadband networks. Internet service providers in Norway and South Korea were also caught throttling the bandwidth available to large purveyors of online video, including the Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation. On the other hand, major phone companies in France and Great Britain support an open online environment, and the European Commission issued a strongly worded statement in favor of net neutrality. Now, the Parliament of the Netherlands has approved two resolutions on near unanimous votes calling for changes in regulation that would require all companies that offer broadband internet service to open their networks to competition. Furthermore, businesses that engage in the ownership of physical broadband network infrastructure should be wholly separate from those that offer services over those networks. These provisions would remove two major incentives for telecom companies to engage in data discrimination. And in Canada, a major cable company has called on the government to institute what in effect would be a tax on the publication and downloading of all internet content, with the proceeds directed toward helping telecom companies build out next-generation broadband network infrastructure. However, a recent government report on the possible overhaul of Canadian telecom policy recommended that a law be enacted that would guarantee a free and open internet for all.
The city of New Orleans is shutting down its citywide free wireless broadband network, handing over the reins to the ISP Earthlink instead. Earthlink says its Wi-Fi network will be free just like the city's was, though it'll be capped at a low speed and higher throughput comes with an undisclosed access charge. Technically, in Louisiana, it is illegal for a public entity like city government to offer free public internet access, except in the case of dire emergencies, but New Orleans defied that order post-Katrina in order to facilitate rebuilding. It attempted to convince the state legislature to carve an exemption into state law to allow its network to continue and grow, but legislation to that effect died earlier this year. And just how do companies exert control over the media? Ownership is but one lever to work with. The spending of money on advertising is another big one. Struggling liberal talk radio network Air America knows the leverage of the latter very well. It's been the target of an advertising blacklist signed onto by more than 90 sponsors. The list of firms involved is a veritable who's who of corporate America and also includes notables like the American Heart Association, United States Postal Service, and U.S. Navy. The group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting broke the story after a memo surfaced from the ABC radio network directing its affiliates that broadcast Air America programming to, quote, black out all advertising from said sponsors. ABC has yet to respond to the revelation. Meanwhile, pop country superstars the Dixie Chicks are feeling more fallout from remarks made by members of the band leading up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Back then, major broadcasters pulled their music from their stations, boycotted live shows, and held CDs smashing parties. Now, ads promoting a new documentary about the Dixie Chicks entitled Shut Up and Sing have been declined by the NBC television network on the grounds that they, quote, are disparaging to President Bush. And now, here's a Media Minute's Fast Fact. Spending on advertising in the 2006 elections topped out above $3 billion, a new record. That's nearly 15% more than was spent in 2004. Television took half the cash, with direct mail campaigns coming in second, although billboard, newspaper, and radio advertising made the greatest gains over their 2004 revenue. More than two-thirds of this money was directed at the state level. Spending in gubernatorial races broke the billion-dollar barrier for the first time. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you this Sunday immediately following Thanksgiving with yet another show. This is a pre-recorded show. We did it a few days before going on air so I could have a bit of a holiday on Thanksgiving weekend. And I hope you'll sit back, relax, and enjoy the show and let me do the talking with my guests. And our guests today are twofold. We have Peter Phillips, the Executive Director of Project Censored, and Andy Roth, the Associate Director of Project Censored, here to talk about the top 25 censored news stories of 2006. Although I guess it's in your new book, Peter, is that right? The 2007 list, but it's the stories from this year, 2006.
It's like an almanac. We call it 2007, and it comes out in September. Mm-hmm. But it covers the stories up through April of last year, of this year, 2006.
And, yeah, Peter Phillips, we've had the privilege of having you on the show in the past to discuss the list, and we're fortunate to have Andy Roth, who's done a lot of the heavy lifting, joining us this year for the first time. You know, for some of our listeners not familiar with Project Censored, Peter, could you just tell a little bit about how long the group's been around, what it does, and then, Andy, maybe you could tell us, you know, how you come up with the list of 25. What qualifies to make a story censored or not censored? So, Peter,
well, back first. Project Censored's been operating for 30 years. This is our 30th listing of the most important news stories that the corporate media did not cover. And there's over 250 students, faculty, national judges that are involved in the selection process each year.
Yeah, and those people, faculty, staff, students, first at Sonoma State, are tracking about 200 print publications and approximately 800 websites. We're also getting stories that are submitted by journalists, librarians, concerned citizens from all over the world. So we're culling this massive array of sources. And the first thing that we're looking at is the potential Project Censored stories are researched for coverage. Are they covered in any significant way in the mainstream corporate media? If they're not, a student then takes charge of that story, and their first step is to go to a faculty evaluator, a professor in a field or one of the fields relevant to that story. And in conjunction, the student and the faculty evaluator evaluate the story for both its relevance and its accuracy. If it passes that rank, then it goes back to the student, and the student does a really in-depth sort of investigation of coverage, content, source reliability. And about each year, approximately 60 or so stories emerge from that process as candidate stories for the that year's censored book. Those are then sent out to a panel of national distinguished judges who rank them in order from 1 to 25.
Now, Peter Phillips, so when you talk about Project Censored, I mean, it's not censored in the sense we think of Big Brother or Darkness at Noon, where some commissar marches into a newsroom and says, don't cover this story, I'm going to shoot you. I mean, it's a slightly different process, right?
No, they threaten you with firing.
Mm-hmm.
All we know for sure on most of the stories is that they weren't covered in the major corporate media in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Knowing why is sometimes a guess. Sometimes a story may be deemed unpatriotic, or we don't want to offend a major advertiser or threaten the sources of news from the Pentagon or the State Department and that. But overall, there's the corporate media's in the entertainment business, and they're filling the news up with what Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt are doing, and not covering important news stories that can help build democracy in America.
We talk about censored in terms of any blockage in the free flow of information that the public would need to be informed as citizens. So any blockage in that free flow of information, for whatever reason, kind of begins to put it in our ballpark.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Peter Phillips, the executive director of Project Censored, Andy Roth, whose voice you just heard, the associate director of Project Censored. We're here talking on Media Matters about the new top 25 censored stories list for 2007, which just came out in September of 2006. This show is being pre-recorded. We did it a few days before going on air. So please don't call in. Sit back, relax. We're going to go through the top 25 and see what has been censored, what stories have not been in the news, and discuss them here on the show today. And number one on the list, and you'll be glad to hear this, Andy and Peter, a topic we've discussed many times on Media Matters. So clearly we're not a factor on what goes on this list. Number one, the future of internet debate ignored by the media. Andy, what is that all about?
This is a story that Elliot Cohen first reported in BuzzFlash in July of 2005. And really, the peg for the story was a June 2005 Supreme Court decision ruling that giant cable companies like Comcast and Verizon would not be required to share their cables with internet service providers. So, in effect, the story is one about what frequently gets described as net neutrality, mm-hmm. in this case the threats to net neutrality as a consequence of this Supreme Court decision. So, federal government all the way from the FCC to the White House and the corporate media have basically worked cooperatively to block open access to cyberspace. The mainstream media have censored, I think it's fair to say, and covered up federal moves to commandeer, monopolize, and turn the internet into a kind of extension of itself. And really, you know, whether it's Fox News or CNN, there's been silence as what Elliot Cohen describes as the greatest bastion of democracy in history is being basically dismantled.
Peter, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I think Andy's been really hitting it on the head. What we're talking about is keeping the World Wide Web open to the world and to people in the U.S. so we can have full access to what's available on the Internet and not have to worry about speed differences. Like the cable companies would like to be able to sell high-speed access priority to MSNBC or Fox, and then Project Censored, you would go to click on the website and you could go walk around the block and then come back and maybe you'd get there.
Our guest today, again, Andy Roth, Peter Phillips from Project Censored. We're discussing the top 25 list for 2007 of the most censored stories in the mainstream news media in the United States. This list, by the way, comes out annually in a book published by Seven Stories Press, and the new book is out now. Is that correct, Andy?
That's correct. The book is out and should be available at people's local bookstores all around.
And it's a book well worth looking at for people interested in the news media. And each of these stories we're going to go through, there are probably different reasons or related reasons why they're not picked up by the news media. Peter, offhand, why do you think the internet story didn't get picked up, given its importance? And let me preface this by saying there are a lot of people in the business community, too, wealthy Americans, who are very concerned about this. This is not an issue only of concern to, you know, Peter Phillips and people on the outside of the power structure in this country?
Well, the corporate media has covered it in the business pages, but they really, you know, they talk about this. It's been there to a certain extent, but very little explanation of what internet neutrality, what net neutrality means, or a real explanation of why people are concerned that that is an important factor for democracy. So what we find in the corporate media, and this is historical for Project Censored for the last 30 years, is they really don't cover their own turf. So if it's about FCC, it's about media consolidation, or it's about major mergers, it might be in the business news on the inside, but it's not covered in terms of where most people will see it, and it's certainly not covered on television news.
Andy, your thoughts?
One of the things I would add, I mentioned earlier the kind of the role of the FCC in this, and I think this may be another factor. That it's perceived by perhaps journalists as being a technical issue that won't interest the public. One of the hinges of the FCC, of the court decision, is basically cable lines are being classified as unregulated information service rather than being regulated as telecommunication service.
Mm-hmm.
And I can imagine, folks saying, oh, well, readers won't care about that. That's too fine a distinction.
Yeah, your eyes glaze over.
That's a crucial distinction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crucial for the public to understand what is entailed if you say it's information rather than telecommunication. I mean, and I'll simplify for the moment. It's just subject to, insofar as the FCC continues to regulate telecommunication, identifying it as information service rather than telecommunication. It's subject to much less restrictions.
Now, Peter and Andy, when did you put to bed this list? I mean, when does your research end for the top 25 list for 2007?
Pretty much by June would have been the last changes that we could have made in a story.
It
has to go to Seven Stories Press and get published. So
the reason I ask is, as you both know, this net neutrality issue has been a raging issue in Congress for the past 6 months, right through to the present day.
Oh, absolutely.
Have either of you sensed that the coverage has improved since you put it to bed in June with your publisher?
Not that we can tell. We haven't seen full explanations of what net neutrality. Most people don't really understand it. Certainly not on the front pages, and we're not seeing the fact that millions and millions of dollars have been spent weekly by AT&T and Comcast lobbying for their version of what they want to see come out of this. So I think a lot of that still remains to be covered.
You know, Andy and Peter, either of you can field this one. When you do this work and you come up with the list and you locate these stories and you have the judges do it and do all this research on it, what is your what's the purpose? What are you trying to accomplish ultimately by doing the hard work of putting out a volume like this?
Well, the stories themselves are important, and they are. It's a message that we've been putting out for 30 years that the corporate media is not giving us the full understanding of what's going on in the world. And most of these stories are about very powerful people inside of government bureaucracies or big private corporations that are making decisions or trying to influence change in the world that's for their benefit, for their profit, for their maximization of power. And whether the neocons inside of the Project for New American Century and their global dominance agenda, or it's AT&T wanting to literally rake in billions, or the oil companies maxing out their profits at $5 to $10 billion a quarter this most recent quarter, it all comes down to the corporate media not covering the powerful in terms of the advantages that they give themselves. And that, I think, is a very important message that we have to continue to put out. I mean, that was what the media, the whole First Amendment was about.
I
would pick up on that and add that, I think a major purpose of the censored yearbooks each year is to educate people about the role of independent journalism in a democratic society. That it's, Peter mentions the First Amendment, and it's effectively been affirmed in numerous Supreme Court decisions that freedom of press is a core principle of democracy. And that's because an informed and active public is essential to democratic self-government. So I would echo that point and add one other, which is that in terms of Project Censored being housed for the last 30 years since its founding here at Sonoma State University, that student education is a crucial aspect of what we do at Project Censored. And to me, one of the most exciting aspects of being involved in the project as a faculty member is working so closely with the students and seeing how a next generation of citizens and potentially journalists are really getting a running start on active involvement and participation through the project. So one of the students who I co-authored a chapter in the book with last year is applying to journalism schools this year, and it's real exciting to be thinking about her making her way in the world that way.
Well, if I thank you very much, Andy Roth, our guest, along with Peter Phillips today on Media Matters. They are both they're the associate editor, director and director of Project Censored, the group out of Sonoma State that puts together the annual report on the top 25 censored news stories of each year. The new edition for 2007 is out, published by Seven Stories Press. And what's the title of the book? Is Project what is the exact title of the book for folks looking it up, Peter?
It's just Censored 2007. Media Democracy in Action. And
and what webpage could folks go to if they wanted to learn more about Project Censored?
ProjectCensored.org.
Well, that makes it nice and simple.
Yeah, it's very simple.
Well, clearly number one on the list is an issue near and dear importance to the future of media, and our listeners are well aware of it. Number two is an issue, I think, of considerable importance to the immediate future of this country and the planet. Number two, Halliburton charged with selling nuclear technologies to Iran. And I confess, I didn't know this until I saw the Project Censored list. What's that all about, Andy?
This is a story that Jason Leopold published back in August of 2005. And according to his sources, inside Halliburton, as recently as January of 2005, Halliburton was selling key components for a nuclear reactor to an Iranian oil development company. So throughout 2004, 2005, Halliburton, the subsidiary, was working closely with the vice chairman of the board of directors for Oriental Oil Kish, an Iran-based company, to develop oil projects in Iran. And these projects are the components. Let's be clear, this story has been misunderstood a few times. Halliburton isn't selling nuclear technology. They're selling technology that would be steps and components towards Iran's nuclear capacity. So at a time where the administration is up in arms about Iran and the threat of a nuclear Iran poses to us, it's, I think, fairly shocking to learn that a company, at least loosely affiliated still with the vice president, has been doing business with folks in Iran.
I mean, they actually sold him a centrifuge. It was one of the items that was listed. And this Halliburton Products and Services is a subsidiary of Halliburton Corporation, but they're registered in the Cayman Islands. That's where they're incorporated. And then they have a office in Tehran.
Now, did this story get picked up by the New York Times, any U.S. News media at all, or is this just Jason Leopold out on his own?
This is Jason out on publishing in Global Research and doing his own thing. This has not been covered anywhere.
Has it been investigated by the Congress or by the Justice Department, State Department? Has this story basically just been done and fell off the face of the earth?
Yep, apparently.
Close to it. I think one of the interesting things that complicates the picture here is that this is the doing business out of the Cayman Islands is a loophole that was created under President Clinton's administration. Clinton signed an executive order in March of 95 that prevented new investments in Iran by U.S. persons, but it left loopholes. And so...
Well, let me ask you this, Peter. If you were to call up the editor of a daily newspaper in California today, right after we finish this show, and tell them about the Halliburton story, and say, why don't you guys cover this? Because I suspect you've had conversations like this on other stories over the past 20, 30 years. What do you think they would say to you?
I remember asking the editor of the Oregonian why they hadn't covered voter fraud in 2004. And his response was not to dismiss the story, but simply say, oh, that's something the Boston Globe or the New York Times should do. And, you know, there's actually a belief, I think, sometimes that if it's not in the New York Times, then it's not a credible story.
Mm-hmm.
I've had people make those kinds of claims as well.
So what would happen if you were to call up the editor of the New York Times and get through, which is a big if, and could have a conversation, present him with what Jason Leopold's piece on Halliburton? What do you think the response would be? Do you have any sense of what the response would be?
I think it would just be speculating to really kind of make a judgment call on that.
Well,
there's a side of this that's just kind of interesting because...
Well, let me put it another way before you go on, because, okay, you said if you talked to the Oregonian, they said, well, the Times or the Boston Globe has to cover it, sort of give it the green light for the rest of us. You've had these conversations with editors over the years. What are some of the other responses in general you get, if not to this story? So you aren't speculating. What's your real-world
experience?
Well,
sometimes they do go on and they get covered. I mean, we'll have one out of three of our stories over the last 30 years has gotten national press, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
But that means that two out of three haven't. So there's still a lot to do. We don't get to talk to editors of major papers very often.
Yeah.
And when we do, there's either a silence, literally a silence. The Boston Globe editor just refused to even respond to a question I asked him publicly last year on regards to voter fraud.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And voter fraud was a big story in last year's list, is that right?
Definitely, yeah. And we've worked on that for 2 years now. It was the 8 million votes in 2004 that were somehow lost in the voting machines that were different from what the exit polls said, and the exit polls just simply couldn't have been that wrong.
Do you think that voter fraud existed from what you've seen so far in the recent 2006 off-year elections?
We don't know yet. I've heard some analysis. There's been real problems in Florida and Ohio with some of the voting machines, but as near as all I've heard so far is what Black Box Voting has been saying, and I heard Robert Kennedy Jr. talking the other day. But it's just too early to tell.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Peter Phillips, you've just heard, the executive director of Project Censored. With us also on the line, Andy Roth, the associate director of Project Censored. This is a pre-recorded show. We're taping it shortly before going on air. So please don't try to call in. Sit back, relax, listen, and enjoy the show. Now, Project Censored is based out of Sonoma State University, has been since it was launched by Carl Jensen back in the 70s. Peter, you are a professor of sociology, is that right?
Yes.
And Andy, you're on the faculty as well?
That's right, also in sociology.
Now, how do your department chair, how does the university president, the trustees of California State or Sonoma State University, feel about having the two of you devoting time to putting together this list of stories and having your students work with you on it?
Overall, they're pretty supportive. The stories generate a lot of attention to Sonoma State. We're getting currently about 50,000 hits a day on our website. And the stories go out worldwide. So it's in the newspapers, in Greece, and stories have been translated into Spanish in South America. We've been interviewed by people in Japan. So, I mean, it gets a lot of attention.
But,
And it's very much an issue of academic freedom. We're the largest faculty union in the world, literally, here at California State Universities, 20,000 faculty. And academic freedom is a core value. It's something that we really, really cherish. And so there's been no effort to, you know, repress us in any way.
Well, I'd add, too, on the student education side that, you know, each semester, each year, we're talking about a couple hundred students who are involved in one way or another, developing things that are critical thinking skills and, I think, to be very blunt, real-world job skills. By working on the project, whether they're working on the PR team to help get the word out, whether they're writing stories for the book, researching stories that might become candidates in the book. I think over the last 30 years, we estimate something about 1,500 students have been involved in Project Censored. And it's been real impressive to me to go to some of the events we have and meet alums, say, from 30 years ago. I met at last year's awards banquet someone who had worked with Carl Jensen the very first year, and his sense of connection to the university 30 years later is, I think, the core root there is the work he did with Project Censored.
Well, you know, as I go look through the list of stories, and it's a very impressive list of stories, they're sort of break into certain genres. Some are foreign policy related, many are information media related, lots of them are public health and environmentally related, and because of what we're going through right now, many of them are war-related. I think they sort of fall into one of those categories. When we look at the second one we've been talking about, with Halliburton charged with selling nuclear technologies to Iran, Peter, if you think that Nancy Pelosi or Harry Reid were to start making a big issue out of this, do you think the press coverage would change? Do you think that a lot of this is just the fact that no political leadership are taking up issues like this?
I think that's certainly a factor.
Yeah.
Andy's shaking his head and he wants to say something.
Well, Andy, go right ahead. We will let you dive in here.
I'm thinking of research by Daniel Holland, who shows that when there's a kind of uniformity of opinion among elites, you get you don't get much in the way of controversial news coverage. But as soon as there's a split in elites, and his research shows this historically for coverage of the Vietnam War and dissent in Congress. As soon as there's a split, you get a very different kind of coverage and a much more contentious kind of coverage. So I'm very hopeful coming out of these midterm elections that with the Democrats taking control of the Congress, that may indeed, if they take charge and really make use of some of these committees that they're now in charge of, that we're going to see action, and we may get people speaking out from within Congress that will transform some of the news coverage. But I think the bottom line is, I'm not going to pin over much hope on that, because I think, if we're talking about corporate interests, the Democrats don't have a halo over their heads either.
Well, let's go to issue number three, the number third story in the top 25, and in the long run maybe will be number one for the decade or one of them. There's a lot here. Everything here is important, so it's hard to really make that call. And I don't envy you trying to make the rank order for this list. Oceans of the World in Extreme Danger. What's that? What story led to that?
Well, this is Mother Jones writing, covering in their April issue this year. Julia Whitty put together this comprehensive review of to the degree to which the oceans of the world are just deteriorating. And when we say oceans, what we're really talking about is one ocean, because the currents and the water moves around the world. So if there's a pollution in the Mediterranean, ultimately that water is off the coast of California. So there's this constant flow constantly around the world, and we're literally turning massive areas of the ocean into dead zones.
What do you mean by I've heard that term, dead zone. What does a dead zone mean?
It means there's nothing left. It's all dead.
Julia Whitty spoke at the Media Accountability Conference that Project Censored sponsored earlier this month, and when someone in the audience asked that, she has a background in scuba diving and underwater cinematography. She said, imagine in the room we were sitting in, all the oxygen being sucked out of that room. And she said, some of us might make it to the door in time to survive, but most of us probably wouldn't. That's a dead zone. She said it's eerie when you scuba dive through these. The visibility is terrible, but she says if you can see the bottom, it's just full of dead creatures. And these are occurring more and more in the mouths of where major rivers drain into the oceans, that as we get runoff from land, raises the temperature and creates these dead zones.
8,000 square miles off the coast of New Orleans there.
And this has not been covered at all other than Mother Jones?
It's been covered. Most of the pieces of the story, like 90% of the fisheries in the world are now gone, and the major fishing stocks. So, we really only have one generation left. Pieces of this have been in media, but nothing has been covering it in a comprehensive way, where we talk about the warming of the oceans, the melting of the ice, the full decay and loss of plankton, the pH balance in the ocean, the declining species. Putting it all together, it's just a devastating, comprehensive story that was actually on the front pages of the San Francisco Chronicle this past weekend. So we're starting to see this kind of coverage now, and they were talking about the fish stocks, that fish will no longer be available to eat in one generation.
Traditionally, stories like this that don't have a quote-unquote news hook or news peg but reflect important long-run trends don't really get caught in the net of mainstream journalism in the United States. Peter, from your experience, or Andy, you can answer too, With a story like this, or really any of the stories in the list, if you look at other countries, Canada, Britain, English language countries, or India, are their news media more likely to pick up these types of stories, or is this a chronic problem with news media across the world?
It's chronic only to the extent that media is consolidating and becoming one big corporate world, you know, television tube. We find often these stories are covered in Toronto, or we're seeing coverage in London, in The Guardian or The Independent, on a great number of these stories, and we're not seeing it here in the U.S.
I think, you know, just adding on that, one of the things that Julia mentioned when she talked to the audience at this media accountability conference I mentioned earlier, she said this story ended up running as a 10,000-word story in Mother Jones. And that was, she had to fight for those 4,000 extra words. And she said, credit to Mother Jones, they were willing to give it to her. But I think part of it is that a story of this sort where, as you mentioned, it doesn't have a kind of a single news hook. It's got hooks everywhere in some ways. There's a kind of complexity to the putting the pieces together, connecting the dots, that isn't well suited to the kind of, you know, 300-word, 500-word, single column coverage that is the staple of, I think, you know, it's fair to say, most international media.
Our guests today on Media Matters are Peter Phillips, the executive director of Project Censored, Andy Roth, the associate director of Project Censored, both sociologists at Sonoma State University. Project Censored has been in operation for 30 years, publishing an annual yearbook with the top 25 most censored news stories based on important stories that get little or no coverage in the mainstream news media in the United States. We've been going through some of the stories on the list. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a few days before going on air, so please don't call in. Sit back, relax, and enjoy listening to WILL AM 580. Andy and Peter, as I go down the list, number four is also the sort of long-term story of extraordinary importance that sort of falls through the cracks. Hunger and homelessness increasing in the United States. What's the story there?
Well, we found this report. It was a U.S. Conference of Mayors report where they annually compile surveys from the cities around the U.S. Showing increases in housing requests, food requests, homelessness. And again, in 2005, when that report came out, 18% increase in the major cities for homelessness, food requests up 12%. So that what they're saying is that homelessness and hunger is increasing in the U.S. At the same time, the Bush administration's budget proposal that was coming out this year wanted to eliminate the Census Bureau survey of income and program participation. In other words, they don't want to count them anymore. So if you don't count them, then the problem will go away. So the two stories together, one was from the New Standard, which was about the Mayor's report, and then the One World Net in March of this year had the story, U.S. Plan to Eliminate Survey of Needy Families Draws Fire, and that was where 415 economists sign a letter to Congress saying, don't do this. We need to know what's going on in this country. So it's an interesting story. We know that poverty and homelessness are up, and one way to try to get rid of that is to not count them.
Andy?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things, the mayor's report is a really authoritative kind of study addressing multiple issues, and what the mayor's report addressed in particular as regards this story, they're looking at 24 major cities, and they're tracking things like requests for food aid, requests for shelter. And what they're showing is that as these requests are going up, their ability their budgets to respond are going down. So the more than three-quarters of the cities surveyed reported increases in demand for food and housing, especially from families. And food aid requests expanded by 12% in 2005, while their budget for those, the Aid Center and Food Bank resources, grew only 7%, so we're seeing a gap increasing there. And a similar kind of story is true for housing.
You know, so you look at
18% of the housing stories requests went untended, according to this mayor's report.
As you look at this list that you've compiled, Peter, of the top 25 news stories, are there a story or two here that you're especially proud of? I mean, stories you think you've got on this list that really would have slipped through the cracks not only of conventional journalists or most citizens, but even people who follow this stuff pretty closely, you know, who go to the FAIR webpage or follow Media Matters, who pay careful attention to news media. Is there a story or two here you're really glad to see you're getting exposure to?
I talk about our story number 7 a lot, and that is how just about a year ago, October 25th, 2005, the American Civil Liberties Union released copies of 44 autopsy reports that were obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. Now, these were autopsy reports done by U.S. military doctors on the bodies of civilians who had died while in custody in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2002, 2003, and 4. Now, these 44 reports, 21 of them listed the deaths as homicides. They were murdered while in custody. And the other 23 were listed as dying from heart failure. Descriptions of their bodies are horrendous. Death by asphyxiation, broken bones, fractured, and hemorrhages and rib fractures and on butt and back and abrasions. And I mean, these people were tortured to death. So ACLU puts out a press release. AP, the Associated Press, picks it up and writes about a 1,000-word news article. It goes out to all 1,700 dailies in the United States. It goes out to all 5,000 radio and television news programs. And last check, we've checked it multiple times now, less than a dozen papers in the United States printed the story, and it wasn't on television news at all. MSNBC had it on their website briefly, but didn't see it as important enough to actually have it on the air. So here was absolute proof that the U.S. had been torturing people to death. Lots of stories about tortures, Iraqis torturing Iraqis, and how we're trying to prevent that and how humanitarian we are. But no context. The story just disappears and has never been mentioned again by AP or any other paper in the country.
How about you, Andy? Is there a particular story on this list, in addition to that one, that you are especially pleased that it's there, that Project Censor can shed some light on the issue?
Yeah, well, one that's been eye-opening for me personally is our number 5 story on high-tech genocide in the Congo.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I saw that headline, and frankly, you're opening my eyes with it, because I knew nothing about it till this list came out.
Two reporters have been tracking this in a really crucial way. Sprocket, who writes for the Earth First Journal, an article called "The High-Tech Genocide" in the June issue of that journal, and Keith Harmon Snow in the Taylor Report back in March of 2005. So let me frame this two ways quickly. One is we've been hearing a huge amount about the genocide in Darfur and much less about the Congo, where perhaps since 1996 estimates are ranging as high as 6 million people have died as a consequence of invasion and war.
How many?
Approximately 6 million.
Over how long of a time period?
This is over the past decade or
okay.
So it's really an ongoing tragedy. Some people have called it the world's most neglected emergency. Here's the kicker, though, on this. So, I mean, I think if that alone makes it a story demanding more attention. We're talking about really complicated geopolitics that are leading to mass death, and not simply in Sudan. But here's the kicker. A lot of the conflict and death in the Congo is over a precious mineral resource called coltan. Coltan is found, 80% of the world's coltan reserves are found in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Coltan isn't a familiar thing to me before I heard of this story, but it's what's used in the production of cell phones and other high-tech electronics. It's used in the tiny capacitors that allow our cell phones and Blackberries and other things to work. And so really all of us are implicated in this, is the message I take away from these reports, that insofar as we're using these products, there's a good chance that your cell phone includes this material, which is extracted from the Congo, traded through foreign traders who buy the mineral and ship it abroad, mostly through Rwanda. Keith Harmon Snow, in his report, emphasizes that what we're talking about is organized crime that's perpetuated through multinational businesses. Sprocket concludes his article by suggesting that all cell phones ought to have a warning on the outside that would say something to the effect of, this device was created from raw materials from Central Africa. The materials are rare, non-renewable, and were sold to fund a bloody war of occupation and have caused the virtual elimination of endangered species. Have a nice day, end of his quote. So I think this is one where it's overshadowed by Sudan and Darfur, and yet we're implicated in this one as powerfully, if not more so, with the kinds of resources that are being fought over in the Congo.
Now, help me, if you will, Andy Roth. Who's occupying whom in the Congo? This is the former Zaire, right?
Right.
I mean, who's doing what to whom?
Well, the borders of the Congo are amorphous, and so you've got the involvement of Rwandan and Ugandan forces who've been in and out of the Congo on a regular basis. You've got internal strife there, and I'm not going to claim to be an expert on the kind of complicated political military relations in the area, but it's essentially what we're talking about, I think, here is not only multiple governments but also organized crime and the influx then of multinational businesses. So it's all kinds of players involved in basically a bloody fight over these scarce mineral resources
and private mercenary armies.
Our guests today on Media Matters, Andy Roth and Peter Phillips, the Associate Director and Executive Director of Project Censored. This is a pre-recorded show, so please don't call in. We're discussing the top 25 censored news stories. Next week on Media Matters, we'll be back to live programming, and our guest will be Noam Chomsky for a full hour live right here in WILL AM 580, so please be sure to join in. The last time I had Noam Chomsky on the air, Peter and Andy, a caller called in and asked him about the theory that the Bush administration had participated in the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center. And Chomsky was quite critical of that theory and, I think, attempted in his way to poke holes in the logical basis of the theory. Quite dismissive of it. And I gathered from Chomsky's tone he had heard been asked that question before. I've had a few people ask me to discuss this issue more on this show in emails over the past 6 months or so. And I couldn't help but notice that number 18 on the top 25 censored news stories for 2007 is Physicist Challenges Official 9/11 Story. So what's the story there?
Well, this is Stephen E. Jones, who's a physicist at most recently at BYU, who's took a look at the collapse speed of Building 7 in particular. He's also extended his research to the towers, but we focused on Building 7, which was the 47-story steel frame building that collapsed at 5:20 in the afternoon of 9/11/2001. And all it had were fires in it. There were fires on a few floors, and then the building came down in 6.6 seconds, which is free fall speed. If you threw a cannonball off the roof, it would take 6 seconds to hit the ground. So the 24 steel core pillars inside this building failed simultaneously. This has never happened before with a fire, before or since. And Jones's hypothesis is that the only way the building could have collapsed in that manner was that it had military-grade thermex in it, or thermite, which is a very iron oxide and aluminum ignited, and it burns so hot, thousands and thousands of degrees centigrade, it melts right through steel instantly. And he says that the molten pools of metal in the basement of that building, and he's done testing now where he's finding signature chemicals, sulfur in particular, and zinc as thermite reactions from that, and he's quite adamant. And he's got a number of scholars around the world supporting him. Two recently from the Swiss Institute of Technology, kind of the MIT in Zurich, saying that, yes, there is a major problem, a big question here on Building 7, why it fell down. So that's the story that we've recognized. And in the past, we have done chapters in our book of the unanswered questions of 9/11, but we don't have a hypothesis or theory as to who was involved or what happened, other than to say that some of the corporations in the U.S., particularly the military defense contractors, have made massive profits on the wars that we've engaged in, And there was strong advocacy for an event like 9/11 to happen to get the Patriot Act through and other things. So we're concerned. We think there's a lot of unanswered questions. We don't completely believe that the 9/11 Commission report was fully adequate. And we want to find good science research that supports continued questions in those areas.
If I can ask a follow-up on that, what this Thermax you said is the material needed to bring
thermite,
about
yeah.
thermite. Who would is that a material that you can get at a hardware store? Who would have access to that the sufficient quantities of that material to bring a building down so quickly?
Well, it's not just having access. Actually, having access to finely ground aluminum and iron oxide is not difficult, but to create a way of igniting that simultaneously inside a building so that all the pillars, that requires controlled demolition quality or really expert capabilities. So this isn't Al-Qaeda people sneaking into the building and putting thermite bombs on it. I mean, this took a sophisticated operation in order to have that building collapse the way it did in its own footprint that fast. So that's what he's saying. And he's got a number of support, a lot of criticism. And we think it's a scientific issue that's been completely ignored by the media. And, you know, there's a lot of criticism of Jones, often from people who've never even read his material. So that's what we find kind of interesting. I can't blame Chomsky or anybody else for not wanting to take this issue on. We think it's a vital question. There have been people that have come forward with wild conspiracies about who did what. We steer away from that. We want to stay with the science, and we want to evaluate what happened on 9/11 because it was really the foundation for the Patriot Act and the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq and a whole transformation, kind of new world order, U.S. military spending stronger than the rest of the world combined. So it's a major turning point in world history.
So you suggested, I mean, I want to follow up on this because this is an interesting story, and you did put it on your list. You're suggesting, if I got what you just said right, Peter Phillips, is that the sophistication required to do this was something beyond what Al-Qaeda operatives probably would have been capable of doing themselves.
Well, the building was a highly secured building. This was an FBI, CIA, NSA building. So even getting access to it would have been extremely difficult.
So that's what you're saying, then?
That's pretty much what we're saying, or that's what Jones is saying.
No.
Building his best hypotheses, the speed of the fall, the molten metal, the collapse, the pulverization of the building and all the concrete in it, the best hypotheses is that there was demolitions in the building.
And how would this connect to Jones's? I mean, Jones must, being a scientist, had some explanation that this didn't just happen by fluke. What connection is that to then the plane attacks on the Twin Towers?
His research, the word we're giving him for was research on Building 7.
Mm-hmm.
He spoke at our media accountability conference this past weekend, or 10 days ago now, to a crowd of 300 people. We had scientists there, and he's showing, you know, the collapse of World Trade Center 1 and 2 as well. And you see a pulverization. Now, a lot of people have accepted the pancake theory that it fell down and the weight collapsed. But what he says is that if where the airplanes hit 1 and 2, if you were just to take the section of the towers above that and just with a big crane move them over and drop them in thin air, they wouldn't have fallen any faster than they fell with the entire building underneath it. So saying conservation of energy, the collapse, that there was nothing in the way. Everything was blown up as it went down because it fell in 10 seconds.
So Jones is saying that there was some hanky-panky with the Twin Towers as well.
He believes that he's got his strongest case is Building 7, but the more he looks at it, they've done analysis of the dust. They've gotten hold of some of the molten metal. And so he's continuing to do research in this area and has a number of people helping him.
So if this is an important story. If I follow this, then Jones's argument is that in addition to having two planes smash into these buildings, before those planes smashed in, someone had done some work internally to sort of undermine the structural soundness of the buildings. Is that correct?
That's basically his hypothesis.
Okay.
We don't know who, except that the physics of the building collapse – do not fit just from an airplane.
And what you said earlier, it sounds like he doesn't believe that Al-Qaeda, what he knows of them at this point, would have the technological sophistication and resources to pull off a job of this magnitude.
Well, I think that going back to that point, I think the more accurate characterization is that this was bigger than the 17 or 18 people who were on board the airplanes identified as the, you know, the terrorists. That if I don't think it's so much a matter of Al-Qaeda, you know, within or beyond their capacity, as that if there is a plot, it's a plot that encompasses more than just the people on board those airplanes that day.
That's his main point.
Most of the people I've dealt with in this issue, almost without exception, and I've had dealt with a few, have linked this specifically to the Bush administration. Does Jones do that?
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't.
He's simply calling for more investigation on the science, the kind of material evidence of what happened and how that could be useful for better understanding the events of that day. But I think he's been very careful not to say that he knows, you know, that he as a physicist has any kind of special inside understanding of who might have done it.
Now, this is a story that has been censored, as I understand it, not only by the mainstream press, but also by the progressive press. Unlike these other stories, this story has not been getting that much attention. You're really going out pushing a story here to no small extent on your own. How does that feel?
We've been criticized for it, and when we look at the science, and we've had our scientists here at the university look at this, it's a credible story. He is raising questions that are undoubtedly need to be raised. And when something like this comes forward, there's often an attack on the person, kind of an ad hominem attack on Jones himself. So he's been criticized for his earlier work in cold fusion, which he had a piece of that issue that he is quite adamant was fully proven and is supportive of. But they've gone after him as a person. And now he has been suspended and has retired at BYU politically. It wasn't his department. It wasn't an internal faculty review. It was a political move at the level of the president there that asked they suggested that he retire. There's no tenure at BYU. He had been there for 20 years and had a 20-year career, and then they had suspended him because this was getting publicity, and they didn't like the negative side of the publicity that it was getting.
There's no tenure at BYU.
No.
I didn't realize that. Heavens. Well, Andy Roth, you know, you've been working on this too. What other stories on the list? We don't have much time left. Would you like to bring to people's attention before the show wraps up?
Well, I think another one that is kind of horrifying, you think, can this be the year 2006, is number 12, the Pentagon plans to build new landmines.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just kind of give a short version and see if Peter wants to add anything on this. The Pentagon basically has requested over $1 billion to develop two new types of anti-personnel landmines, the first of which would come out as early as next year. We haven't used anti-personnel landmines since the first Gulf War, but this move would end basically a moratorium that was signed into place by George H.W. Bush in 92, and it would call into question the United States' previous intention to be part of a 145-country coalition that signed the 97 mine ban treaty.
You know, regrettably, Andy, I've got to stop here. Our time is running out. I hear the band tuning up. That means they're going to try to be getting Tavis Smiley in the studio to take over from now. That's a great sounding story. I want to thank Andy Roth and Peter Phillips for being my guest today on Media Matters. They are the directors of Project Censor, the group that has the brand new book out, Project Censor 2007. You can find it in bookstores or Google Project Censored on the web and go to their website at project.censored.org. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. Good luck with the book, and we'll talk to you next year when you have the next volume out.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, bye-bye.